Good afternoon and happy Thanksgiving. Welcome to the EcoNews Report. This week, your hosts are from the North Coast Environmental Center with Executive Director Larry Glass and Admin and Development Director Bella Waters. The EcoNews Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, EcoNews. Don't forget you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Today we'll be providing brief snippets of current news that pertain to various environmental topics, such as what the current election results mean for Humboldt County, Mercer Fraser's Hatch Lab projects, how humans can save wildlife from oblivion, microplastics, and current climate change news. What's up first, Larry?
Well, first up, Bella, we can't let the local elections go by without commenting. Many of the Eureka races, particularly the District 4 Harbor District race, became a referendum on harbor and bay development and the East-West Railroad because it became a political issue raised by one of the candidates, basically telling us to support her and, you know, she'd get her done. The voters weren't having that at all. And it also got raised in the Eureka City Council races. Several of the candidates, specifically the Ward 1 candidate, made that a big issue. Build the railroad. Soundly defeated, I might add. Mm-hmm. So doesn't look like the build the railroad concept has got a lot of traction here locally, and we're sort of glad to hear that. Back on the front burner again are two issues that had sort of faded into the background, and that was these two Mercer Fraser Hatch Lab projects, the one being located on the Mad River, which we've talked a lot about in the past, that's near the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District's intake wells, and they're wanting that zoned industrial instead of agricultural. And in Willow Creek, where they're still just determined to build this hash lab, mm-hmm. and that property is near the Big Rock Recreation Area and right near a elementary school.
Right.
So not a popular project in that area either. And there's one aspect of that project that's still just stuck in my craw, and that's the idea that they are basically using public land. Mercer Fraser has this giant pile of spent debris of some type or other that's now got old-growth bushes growing on it. So mm-hmm. they've been utilizing it for a long time. And it's there with no permit. They're not paying their fees. They don't have a legal right to be occupying public land like that. Now, if those were forest defenders doing that, they'd be being dragged away. Right. If that was a private landowner that had accidentally gone across their property boundary and was, you know, using federal land, they'd be cited with federal trespassing. But yet Mercer Fraser is being allowed to get away with this now for at least a decade or longer that mm-hmm. we know of. We've made a complaint to the IG's office in Washington to investigate it, but we've heard nothing back from them. Anyways, those projects are back on the front burner. You'll have to stay tuned for dates of hearings and whatnot that are coming up for that. Another cannabis project, and they love to just jam these through, and it seems like they like to pick the most unrealistic sites to place these. So this one is a project that they call Sensi Valley, and it is on the Van Dusen River, just to the east of the town of Dinsmore. And it's an old contaminated mill site. It used to be the home of Twin Harbors Stud Mill a long time ago along the Van Dusen. That one has now gotten the attention of our member groups, Friends of the Eel River, and Humboldt Baykeeper, who have filed an appeal of the Humboldt County Planning Commission's decision to approve the project in the floodplain of the Van Dusen River. So that will come before the supervisors at some point. Once again, we'll send out alerts on that, check our website, and we'll give you dates when they become available.
Mm-hmm. Next up is an article in Grist on protecting public lands was a winning platform in elections out west, which we saw with the Eureka City Council elections. Democrats notched wins in a number of key midterm races out west after running on platforms of protecting public lands and maintaining them under federal control. Victories that conservation groups are celebrating as a repudiation. Oh, that's a word you don't hear very often, of the Trump administration's energy dominance agenda. The administration's deeply unpopular rollbacks of protected national monuments and its sweeping proposal to open up nearly all U.S. waters to offshore oil and gas development fueled conservation wins in states like Nevada, New Mexico, and even South Carolina.
Well, many of us in Northern California have heard the just outlandish statements that Trump has made, both when he was back in Washington and when he came to Northern California and was at the site of the campfire that completely destroyed the town of Paradise, which he called Pleasure. Anyways, but he clearly does not understand what's going on, and he blamed poor forest management for the disaster. Of course, that fits his agenda because it gets people's attention off of what the real cause is, which is dramatic climate change. We can no longer just call it climate change. It's dramatic climate change. And it's happening fast. And, you know, when Santa Rosa happened last year,
right,
people thought, whoa, that's a once in a 50-year kind of event. Well, obviously not.
Right.
And you have to wonder whether these type events are just going to keep escalating each year and getting worse and worse. But, you know, his remedy was to cut off aid. That's what he suggested. Cut off aid to federal payments to California. But that's actually what repeatedly has been done by Republican-controlled Congress for the last 10 years, has been to cut the funding of the Forest Service. So there isn't enough money for them to even do part of, just even if they got their full funding, I don't know that they could catch up with all they need to do from fire suppression. You know, all of the years of fire suppression that's allowed all this undergrowth to take place and brush growth and whatnot, a lot of work to be done out there.
Right.
So, but cutting funding is not the way to do it. So one concept that people have to get straight is they keep calling these forest fires, particularly the Woolsey Fire, which is down by Malibu. That's actually grass and chaparral that burned down there. And what's happening down there is that native chaparral are the dominant shrub species that evolved with fire every several decades to every century or so. Human activity has shortened the time between fires, however, which kills the native chaparral species before they can produce seeds. These frequent fires seem to be made to order for invasive species, though. So these invasive shrubs and grasses are moving in, and they can burn every year. So that's what's going on there. And with the campfire, that was some timber, but lots of brush and grass as well. And that involves people building basically suburban areas into the forest lands. What studies have shown is once man-made structures catch fire, they burn way hotter than the forest burns. And so the fire starts spreading a lot faster. Plus you have very toxic smoke coming from the man-made structures. And as witnessed by many of us who watched several years ago the fire in Ventura, which at the time they had helicopters flying over the fire when it was first really rolling, and so there was like live video of these fires, and what was happening was they were going building to building, house to house. The vegetation wasn't even burning. It was the houses that were catching fire. So to call them forest fires is disingenuous at best.
Mm-hmm. So how do they come up with the names for these fires? You got campfire and car fire.
Yeah, well, and most of these names are named after some geologic place, some topographic place on the map. Car fire was Car Creek. Campfire, I'm not sure, but I bet there's some place there called Camp Creek or camp something that was nearby, and so hence it carries those names. But they usually have a geographic basis to the name.
Got it. All right, what do you have next for us?
Well, here's actually a bit of good news, I think, anyway. A study out and from Europe says that eating organic food can significantly lower your cancer risk. People who buy organic food are usually convinced it's better for their health and they're willing to pay dearly for it. But now, evidence of the benefits of eating organic food have been displayed in a new French study that followed 70,000 adults, most of them women, for 5 years, and reported the most frequent consumers of organic food had 25% fewer cancers overall. This is pretty significant because a lot of the big food manufacturers kind of poo-poo organic and say that people are paying too much for it. But the point is that commercially grown food, they use chemical fertilizer and synthetic fertilizers and pesticides routinely. I mean, over and over again. They're also using GMO crops in there as well, because those are the ones that have been altered so that they can withstand the onslaught of chemical fertilizers and pesticides. So the results are even more significant when you look at the frequency of lymphomas. So that went down 76% for lymphomas, and 86% down with non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, which is actually a pretty common form of cancers. So anyways, I find, you know, organic food tastes better anyway, but here's a good reason to spend a few extra bucks not buying the chemically contaminated food.
Right. Next up, the article is, "We Know How to Save Wildlife from Oblivion, So Let's Do It." A new report found a shocking 60% drop in average wildlife population since 1970s. For those of us who love our living planet, this is a gut punch. The U.S. Endangered Species Act works when it's used and enforced. The Center for Biological Diversity examined the long-term population trends of all species placed on the list between 1976 and 1980. In the 40 years after listing, those populations grew between 180 to 390%, and the results are even stronger for birds. The reason is simple. Advocates are saying we need a global Endangered Species Act. Because when actively managed, endangered species listed birds are successful.
So on a related topic, and I want to preface this one by saying we're not taking a position against wind turbines, but we need to be sober about the impacts that they have. So this article was from Scientific American, and it's talking about how wind farms and wind turbines can act like apex predators. Wind farms are popping up all over the world. In U.S. alone, wind power capacity has tripled over the last decade. Although the trend is good news for efforts to curtail emissions and climate change, a growing body of research suggests wind turbines disturb the local environment in a significant way. Scientists have documented, for example, wind turbines killing hundreds and thousands of birds and bats. Now, many of us had heard that before. But what this study gets to that we hadn't seen before is the sort of down the food chain. So they studied lizards that the birds fed on, and they found the lizards more plentiful in the areas where the wind turbines, so makes sense. But what they also found was less diversity amongst those lizards than the lizards that lived where the birds were picking them off. And they were more lethargic, and they were skinnier, and they weren't thriving, probably from overcompetition.
Right.
So these are secondary and tertiary effects of all of a sudden, not just birds being killed, and that's another thing this study points out, it's birds avoiding the wind turbines. So they're not even going into the areas where these wind turbines are, and thereby beginning to disrupt the whole ecologic chain that's taking place in that area. Anyways, this, like I said, was a report in Scientific American. It's a lengthy report, and if you're interested in that, I would encourage you to go to their website and read the whole report. Mm-hmm. So next up, as we've been talking to you about here on the Eco News Report Roundup, microplastics. And the latest study out shows that microplastics are found in 90% of table salt.
Ooh, it's a high number.
Let me say that again, 90% of table salt. Now, 39 brands of salt were tested, 36 had microplastics in them. And it didn't matter where they came from. The density of microplastics varied, found in salt dramatically amongst brand, but those Asian brands were particularly high. The highest quantities of microplastics were found sold in Indonesia. But this is a worldwide phenomenon. And the question, of course, everybody has right now is, are microplastics harmful?
Right.
We don't know. But a new study estimates that an adult consumes about 2,000 microplastics per year through salt. But what that means, like I said, is a mystery. There needs to be some studies so that we can gauge the health effects, if there are any, of consuming what seems to be an ever-increasing amount of microplastics.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you've got something on that same
right. So another article in Scientific American says, solving microplastic pollution means reducing, recycling, and fundamental rethinking. To get the microplastics problem under control, the world has to take three primary steps. Those who study the issue say, in the short term, society needs to significantly curtail unnecessary single-use plastic items, such as water bottles, plastic shopping bags, straws, and utensils, which we've talked about. In the medium term, governments need to strengthen garbage collection and recycling systems to prevent waste from leaking into the environment between the trash can and the landfill, and to improve recycling rates. In the long run, scientists need to devise ways to break down plastics into their most basic units, which can be rebuilt into new plastics or other materials. There's definitely no single solution.
So about 2-3 years ago, Humboldt County Democrats, during their Democrat of the Year dinner, which I was proud to be a recipient of, along with NEC board member Chris Beresford, the keynote speaker was Tom Steyer. We all got to meet him. Very interesting, charismatic person for a billionaire. I usually don't care for billionaires very much, but he was pretty cool. And he had lots of sort of radical things to say at the time. Anyways, everybody that met him really liked him. So we found an article here that was in Mother Jones about a link between hate groups and climate deniers. So as many of you are probably aware, Tom Steyer has been funding a couple of different campaigns, one calling for the impeachment of Trump, and the other one was a big Get Out the Vote initiative for this last election, which I would say was pretty successful. But he is also the recipient, or one of the intended recipients, of one of the 13 bombs that the supporter of Trump had sent to Trump's critics. And so people started looking into that and finding that there was a link between climate change, science denial, and these real extremist groups. And they looked at the patterns where they appropriated Nazi and anti-Semitic imagery and demonization of the people involved with the movement, and they've drawn a direct parallel between there. So it's gone beyond your political positions. Just believing in climate change can put you on the target of some of these haters. So we came upon this article. Now, many of you had heard about the IPCC report from the UN about their alarming report about global warming and, you know, the clock is ticking and the time must be almost up. Well, we found an article here on Motherboard from Vice, and it is an article basically saying that that report is being, while some are criticizing it for being too alarmist, this report says it's too optimistic and too conservative, that what's actually happening, they're saying a decade ago, the father of global warming, the first scientist to sound the alarm on climate change in the 80s to the U.S. Congress, announced that we were too late and the planet had already hit the danger zone. That was a decade ago. And in a landmark paper, James Hansen, the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, along with seven other leading climate scientists, described how the global average temperature above 1 degree Celsius, involving the level of carbon dioxide at around 450 parts per million, would lead to practically irreversible ice sheet and species loss. But new data is suggesting now that even 1 degree centigrade is too much, and that things are just spinning out of control, and the effects of all this are unpredictable at this point because we haven't seen anything like this before. So anyways, so some people are taking action. The crab fisher people are suing the fossil fuel industry over climate change. A lawsuit by the largest West Coast Commercial Fishing Association seeks to hold 30 companies accountable for harming shellfish and their livelihoods as the ocean warms. Crab fishing on the West Coast has become so threatened by warming waters that a coalition of commercial fishers has joined the climate litigation fray with a lawsuit filed Wednesday to hold 30 fossil fuel companies accountable for losses caused by climate change. The lawsuit filed in San Francisco County Superior Court by the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association seeks damages on behalf of crab fishers, their businesses, and families and local communities in California and Oregon. Now, I believe you've got a story where students...
Yes, so from the Washington Post, the Supreme Court refuses to block young people's climate lawsuit against the U.S. government. The Supreme Court on Friday night, and I believe this is earlier this November, refused to halt a novel lawsuit filed by young Americans that attempts to force the federal government to take action on climate change, turning down a request from the Trump administration to stop it before trial. The suit filed in 2015 by 21 young people who argue that the failure of government leaders to combat climate change violates their constitutional right to a clean environment is before a federal judge in Oregon. It had been delayed while the Supreme Court considered the emergency request from the government. Justices Clarence Thomas and Neil M. Gorsuch would have stopped the suit. The other justices did not indicate how they voted on the government's request. The court's three-page order said the government should seek relief from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. It noted the government's assertion that the suit is based on an assortment of unprecedented legal theories, such as a substantive due process right to certain climate conditions and an equal protection right to live in the same climate as enjoyed by prior generations. The justices acknowledged that the Ninth Circuit had previously turned down the government, but said those decisions came when there was a likelihood that plaintiffs' claims would narrow as the case progressed. That no longer seems the case, the undersigned opinion said, suggesting the possibility that the Ninth Circuit might see things differently now. And it left open the possibility that the government could return to the Supreme Court. The goal of the lawsuit is to compel the government to scale back its support for fossil fuel extraction and production and to support policies aimed at reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to global warming. Julia Olson, the attorney for the use and executive director of Our Children's Trust, said, "We've been confident throughout the case that we would get to trial, and I believe that we will get to trial. We have overcome everything the government has thrown at us. It is not luck. It is the strength of the case and the strength of the evidence and the strength of the legal arguments we are making."
So a lot of people who hear this show stop me on the street and ask me, okay, I can see the climate is changing and that the planet is warming. I accept that. But I don't understand why it's affecting the weather the way it is. So I'll just try and give a real brief sort of summary of one way that that's affecting our weather directly. And that involves the impact on the jet stream. Now, the jet stream is a powerful high-altitude wind that is basically a track that storm systems follow, kind of like you've been on those rides at amusement parks where there's a track above you and the ride follows that track. Similar to that. So there's upper atmosphere wind current that guides storms. So normally that's in a very sort of slight wavy pattern that cuts across the northern part of the United States. And if you're at the low end of the wave, you're usually seeing a rain event or at least a cold low passing your vicinity. If you're in where it goes up, then you're usually have fair weather. It's usually in the summertime, it can be very hot and stagnant and in those areas. So as the jet stream becomes more amplified, which it has since the Earth has been warming, those dips go lower and the rises go higher. And once they get that amplified, they're less inclined to move as easy. So we're going to get stuck in a pattern. So we can be stuck in a pattern with, like we have been for the last 3 or 4 months, where we've just had a high pressure parked over us and it hasn't moved. Now it's starting to move away, and we're going to see a whole series of storms come in as the jet stream, the wave pattern, the dip, is basically over California. So we're going to be seeing one storm after another for, right now they're saying about a week. But that's what's happening, is that jet stream becomes more and more erratic, the weather becomes more erratic. And we have wind events, we have heat waves, we have floods, they'll have snow when they're not expecting it on the East Coast like they had a few weeks ago.
Right.
So that's what's going on. It's the jet stream. At least that's one of the main factors that's causing the freakish extreme weather.
Mm-hmm.
And it's forecast to get even weirder. So we wanted to end on this positive note from Inside Climate News. There's a new study that addresses the potential of U.S. forests, farms, and other landscapes to store carbon and help offset a large part of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. Conserving and restoring America's forests, farms, and natural lands could cut a substantial chunk of the country's emission. This was a study by 38 researchers, and they're saying that if deployed across agricultural lands, forests, grasslands, and wetlands, it could mitigate 21% of the country's net annual greenhouse emissions, getting the U.S. closer, at least, to meeting its goals under the Paris Climate Agreement that Trump tried to get out of. But anyways, basically they're saying it's the same as if every car and truck in the country stopped polluting. That's the kind of impact that we could have. So that seems like a viable thing that we could do that wouldn't cost us an arm and a leg.
Mm-hmm.
So on that positive note, happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving. All right, this has been the Eco News Report with Larry Glass and Bella Waters, and we've been your hosts for the past half hour. You can find more information about the issues we've discussed on the NEC website, www.yournec.org. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Previous shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again right here for the next Eco News Report.